Welcome to the Heal Through Play podcast, where we explore healing through play. I'm your host, Lisa Dovgish, and I am a spiritual life coach, energy healer, light code activator, improviser, and self-proclaimed meme lord. My goal with this podcast is to bring light into the otherwise dark process of shadow work and healing by featuring guests from all walks of life who share their stories of healing mental, emotional, and even physical wounds through the magic of playfulness. Whether that be performing improv, creating art, doing yoga, choosing to be silly and lighthearted, or anything else in between. Hey guys, welcome back. So today on the podcast, we have Elizabeth Warm, who I am just so excited to have because she has so much expertise in so many different, very interesting fields that I want to dive into today. But I'll let Elizabeth introduce herself. So tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Warm, and I have come from a lot of different backgrounds. So primarily right now, I am an Enneagram coach, and we can talk about what that looks like. What is the Enneagram? And I got my bachelor's and master's in theater. So I have a lot of background in the theater arts, and I also went through the Improv Shops training program a few years ago. So I personally love to fuse the arts and the Enneagram together, and that's what I did my master's thesis on. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So those are the areas of passion that I have. I also love to talk to, I'm also working on personally being anti-racist and looking at practicing anti-racism, and how can I use the Enneagram to do that too? So I've done some work around that. I'm a big Brené Brown fan. For any of those of you who know Brené Brown, she is a researcher, storyteller out of the University of Texas, Houston, I believe. And so she actually talks about how important rest and playfulness is. And so I've discovered the importance of play through all of my side hustles, striving and working. The importance of play is really important. And one reason it's important is I have an autoimmune disease, which is called Crohn's disease. It's where my immune system attacks my gut basically and thinks it's foreign. And so a lot of painful things come from that. And so I was diagnosed in 2015 in the midst of me being the biggest hustler at the time. I was working full time, going to grad school, running a theater company on the side, and I was so, so sick. And so a lot of what Brené Brown talks about of resting and playing, that takes a lot of vulnerability. And so through, I didn't just stop, you know, doing everything. I found productive ways to slow down and help heal my body. And actually improv was one of those things. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
I love that. I kind of want to dive into what you said about how, you know, rest and play takes vulnerability. I want to hear just specifically from your experience, what did that look like for you, that vulnerability?
Yeah. So what I've realized is it's my self-worth is tied up in what I do. So what I do defines who I am, how successful I am, how many people like me. Am I worthy of love? Am I worthy of acceptance and belonging? And Brené talks about how all humans are worthy of acceptance and belonging and worthy of love. You're worthy of connection. And shame, she researches shame. Shame is the idea that if somebody knew something, this thing about me, then they wouldn't want to have connection with me and I wouldn't be worthy of the connection. And so shame actually is neurobiologically in our brain. It causes us to distance ourselves from other people and from parts of our own self. And so feeling that shame around, am I not doing enough? If I don't show up to this event, people aren't going to see that I'm there. I'm going to miss out. And then people are going to be like, well, who does Elizabeth think she is that she can miss this event? Or who does Elizabeth think she is? That's the voice of shame. And shame kind of combats our self-worth. And so it's vulnerable for me to say, you know what, I'm going to sit this event out. I'm going to not direct this show, or I'm not going to take this class. Instead, I'm going to allow myself a little more time to sleep or a little more time to meal prep because that's taking care of myself. And those are some things that take vulnerability, because otherwise I would be out there networking and working and everything like that. And so me resting and is trusting that my worth is secure regardless of what I do. And so it's separating my identity from my behavior and knowing that my behavior will still have consequences of what I do. And maybe I won't get an opportunity because I wasn't present with someone, but it doesn't reflect on who I am as a person.
Wow. That is incredible. I love that so much. Yeah. There's just so much to chew on there, right? To like think on. I love that. Yeah. And for everyone listening, I want to take note of what Elizabeth just said about how, yeah, it does take vulnerability to, you know, care for yourself and face that shame. Yeah, I love that so much. So something that I want to dive into is something you said to me about how when you first got into improv, it was really jarring for you because of your personality type. So could you speak more on that? And just kind of also share about like your journey, you know, getting into improv, because I think with your Crohn's disease and, you know, getting into improv, there's like a very interesting storyline there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I met Kevin McKernan, who is the owner of the improv shop. We were in grad school together.
And just for context, for anyone that doesn't know, the improv shop is a improv theater in St. Louis.
Yeah. And they have their own training program. They have teachers that have been through Second City's programs and all sorts of things, good things in Chicago. So it's an amazing gem in St. Louis. So plug for the improv shop. So Kevin McKernan was in my directing class in grad school, and he was telling me about improv, and I had never actually done improv. I've done a lot of other areas of theater, but I had never done improv before. And so he was like, you should just take a class, just one. If you hate it, you don't have to do it again. So I took the first class. I was really surprised that I was the only quote theater person there. There were 18 people in my first class, and everyone had a different story as to why they were there. Some people said, I need new friends. I don't see people during the week and I need some friends. This is another guy said that his girlfriend had given him a gift card. And so he showed up and he's like, I guess I'm here.
That's so funny.
Someone said that they wanted to be better at public speaking. So that's why they were there. So there was all sorts of people there with different reasons behind being there. I was the only one with like a professional theater background, but it really didn't separate us, like me having theater experience and them not having theater experience. It was all like we were all on this journey together, all at the very beginning. So one thing I realized about my personality is I am the type of person that filters what I say to please other people. So I'm a people pleaser. It's not just like throwing out compliments or flattery or types of things, but being aware of what other people need and then giving it to them is kind of my way, again, of earning worth. And it's an autopilot way of learning worth. And I've learned this about myself through the Enneagram, which I can talk about later, but I didn't realize that I was doing that. It was an unconscious thing of kind of being a chameleon and reading my audience and what do people need to hear? What will be the most considerate thing to say? What would be something that would encourage them and or make it easy for them to understand whatever it is? And so I automatically use this filter in all areas of my life. Kind of a chameleon, I can shape shift and be whatever the audience wants me to be. One thing about improv is that there's no time for filters.
Yep. I was about to say, I was like, that limits so much of your experience when you're
So
filtering that
much.
way. Yeah.
Yep. So one amazing thing about improv is you are on this team and everyone has to support you. Whatever you say, they're going to say yes to. And whatever anyone else says, you say yes to. Even if it's dumb or stupid or it doesn't make sense, you just go with it. And so part of what the improv shop does is they train you how to be a team, how to be a functioning team and a unit that is a supportive, encouraging team. And, we don't get that in life. We don't get that type of, I want to call it like a church. Like, honestly, out of all the churches I have been to in the world, improv church
We're gonna
is
start it
the,
now.
yeah, it was the most
Dibs, dibs,
accepting.
improv church.
Yes,
Troop name.
it was the most accepting environment, the most encouraging environment where people just say, you be you, and I will support that. So that props to creating that environment, which then the other thing about improv is you are not trying to be funny yourself. You're trying to set up your partner, your scene partner for the punchline, if there is a punchline. Another thing about improv is it's your truth telling. You're not trying to be funny. You're trying to be the most real because the realness on stage reflects people's lives in the audience. And when you're in the audience watching something real happen and you're like, oh, that totally happened to me yesterday, that's funny. And so being able to share the truth about the human condition is so important to the art of improv. And I love that they teach that. It's not just about jokes or being funny. So I had to become a truth teller. That's scary. Talk about vulnerability.
Right. After having that filter for your whole life and every aspect of your life, now it's like, actually, let's remove that and see what's
Yeah.
underneath.
Yes. And underneath, I can be funny. But it wasn't that I was trying to be funny, but it was I actually have some truths to share that sometimes can be provocative, but other people welcomed that. And so it became a place where I could say anything and it was accepted. And that also unleashed a lot of creativity in me because I was using so much energy to stifle what I thought. And so now I can just unleash creativity and unleash truth, and art will be made with it because that's just how improv works. So that was really freeing. There were a lot of exercises we would do. I remember there was one exercise in level three, which is about just scene work. And we would just delve into these little scenes and just find these moments of truth. There was an exercise where you stand with your scene partner and you talk to them for a whole minute. And they aren't allowed to react or say anything. And then after a minute, you switch and then they talk for a whole minute and you're not supposed to react. I mean, you kind of sometimes it's funny and so you want to laugh, but you're trying to remain stoic. I had had a really frustrating event happen and I hadn't told anybody about it. And, I could be as anonymous as I wanted to be, but when it was my turn, I just talk to the person like I was going to talk to the person that somebody had really hurt me in life. And I was just like, I'm going to be honest. This is how you made me feel. And I just was really honest and it was really cathartic.
I just want to pause there because that is such a powerful aspect of having an art form like improv at your disposal, because you are able to just, and it's funny because I'm so glad you brought it up, because I keep th this is something that I keep thinking about the past few days, about how, in improv, a lot of the times teachers and the beginning levels would say, like, leave your shit at the door, right? Like, whatever day you're having, leave it at the door. Here, you're here to play, right? And it's funny because, yes, I would like leave my moody attitude, at the door if I was having a bad day, but I would bring that into the scenes, right? Like if somebody had hurt me, like I've literally done exactly what you did in scenes so many times. And those end up being the best scenes because you are speaking your truth, right? So, wow, that's so incredible and like powerful. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So anyway, that those are just a few examples. I will say there is one other form of improv. It's called the deconstructed herald. And for any of you improv fans out there, basically the form, the game is that you have two people and they do like a 5-minute scene. And then the rest of the team comes in, they break the scene up with little commercials that are kind of inspired by what happened in the scene. And then you go back to the same two people that were having that first scene and they do a scene for 3 minutes. And then the commercials happen. And then you go back to the scene for 1 minute. And I was in this scene with a scene partner. His name is Andy. And we did some good scenes together. And we discovered one thing that's so fun about improv is you discover what's happening as you go. So there's no planning. You're just discovering. We discovered that we were married and we were unhappily married and we were having a fight in our living room. And our living room was all white. And he hated the fact that it was all white, that I had apparently, you know, all white furniture and white carpet, and he just hated it. And I was holding a glass of red wine. And so I started spilling the red wine on everything to make it better for him. And we were having this big fight about it. And it turned into, should we get a divorce? And 5 minutes is a long time to be stuck in a scene with somebody. And, you know, in real life, when you're having a fight, people might leave the scene, they leave the room. But in this game, we couldn't leave. We were stuck together for 5 minutes. And so we had already decided, okay, well, maybe we should just get a divorce. And in a movie, maybe you would just end the scene there. You would cut it, but we couldn't cut it because we still had a couple minutes left to go. So then we had to talk about, well, what does that actually mean? And we ended up having this really deep scene that was, again, really cathartic. I wasn't working any of my own shit out in that scene. That was not reflective of anything going on in my own life. But I mean, just to the vulnerability that it takes to be in a scene with someone and talk about feelings and be honest in as much as you can be, and that person is supporting you by agreeing that this is what's happening in the scene, that I just remember that being a really amazing exercise. And so then, you know, the commercials happened. And so then we ended up the 3-minute scene. We did a flashback to when we were happily married. And so that was kind of nostalgic because we knew where we were going to end up. And then the 1-minute scene that we ended up doing, was the scene where we just met at a coffee shop. And that was, everybody was like, oh, that's so bittersweet because you know how it ends. And so it was just, that scene stuck with me. I wish that I could do that all over again, just to experience that vulnerability and that catharsis and that support, the no filter from, you know, just being an asshole and pouring red wine all over your husband's white living room. Like,
I love it so much. That's incredible.
That was a really fun scene.
And Andy is also such an incredible improviser. So yeah, I can only imagine that scene being incredible. Okay, so I want to move back. If there was anything else that you wanted to share about your experience, you know, going into improv and then, you know, having that experience of now having to speak your truth, right? And I want to hear specifically about how that you feel like affected your Crohn's disease, if at all.
Yeah, so one of the big causes of symptoms flaring. So it could be like diarrhea, it could be abdominal pain, it could be a pain in other areas. I have chronic pain in other areas of my body. It could be nausea, it could be joint pain even, is stress. And one other thing about my personality type is that I feel other people's emotions and I go do something about them. But when it comes to my emotions, I often repress them because I'm trying to make space for other people's emotions. Again, coming back to that self-worth of if I need to care about other people so that they will care about me. And if I don't, if I'm not the most helpful, likable person, then I will be all alone and no one will take care of me. And so not realizing that I am worth being taken care of and I'm worthy of interest, just being me, not having to be the person that is the most likable or cheerful or helpful. All of that repression gets repressed into our bodies. So I don't know if you've read The Body Keeps the Score, or there's another book that I've read recently called Try Softer. And it talks about all how our bodies are, we're whole beings, we're holistic beings. So we like to think that we have a head and a heart and a gut, and they're not talking to each other, but they are. And there's a book called Burnout. And Brené Brown actually interviews the authors of that. They talk about completing the stress cycle and how stress gets stuck in our bodies. And if we don't complete the stress cycle, that stress becomes chronic pain and symptoms of whatever.
Yeah. And I want to add also for anyone that's, you know, interested in learning about this topic, as Elizabeth said, there's, you know, those resources. And then Lois Hay actually does a lot of similar work and has written a lot of books around the same topic of the mind, body, you know, spirit, healing, how those are all connected. So just a little note for anyone listening.
Yeah. So learning about how everything is connected, and if I don't complete that stress cycle, I'm going to have emotions get stuck in my body. That's going to turn into some sort of pain after a while, because our bodies can only handle so much. We can only carry around resentment or fear or anxiety so long. And so anyway, learning about ways to complete the stress cycle, learning about, which involves sometimes talking about it, venting, sometimes crying, sometimes going for a walk, doing some sort of exercise. Breathing is a huge one. Breathing exercises, the 20-second hug, where you actually, you know, get to your body feels the other person, and it's a prolonged hug, and it really creates, I think it's oxytocin in your brain. So those are some ways that you can complete the stress cycle. And if we don't allow ourselves to find these moments of rest and play, then we end up burning out. And for me, burning out includes days in bed because I'm sick or running to the bathroom all the days. I had a job at the time when I finished my improv training. I had a job where I was traveling. I was a meeting planner for a while when I got to travel to a lot of cool cities, but I was working 16-hour days back to back. And I have dietary restrictions because of Crohn's. So I was having to bring all my own food in my suitcase, not getting enough sleep. Sleep is really huge to maintaining a wellness, Crohn's. And I was the sickest I've ever been in 2018. So I was not allowing myself any downtime to rest or play. And play is essential just for not just your physical body, but for your mental body, you know, because we need a break. We need to experience something other than work the entire time. And Brené's done research on how when you, and I also read this book called Rhythms of Rest. Now it's a spiritual book. If you're a spiritual person, you might like it.
We're going to have a lot of spiritual people on this podcast listening. Okay. So you can share all the woo-woo.
But just talking about kind of forming a rhythm of Sabbath, of a one day a week, forming a day where, you know, you don't have work, and that allows the brain to rest. And then you have more energy to tackle the problems of the week. You have more energy in your brain space, and you're solving problems that you were stuck on before. So I know that I've experienced it in my body. If I am working too much and not allowing myself that time to rest, to sleep, but also to rejuvenate my soul and my spirit through that playfulness, then I'm not going to be at 100%.
That's amazing. Yeah. I love how you're sharing about, you know, the fact that it is so important for for just to recharge your battery. But something else that I want to point out is the conversation we were having about emotions, right? And being able to come into this space of purely emotional beingness in improv, right? Mm. Whether it's just the made up emotions, right, of the scene that are pertaining to the reality of that scene, or if it's your own emotions being channeled, of experiences that you've had, of things that you need to release, right? That closing out that stress cycle, if I'm understanding that correctly, if that's kind of what that means, right? So it's just fascinating how having a tool like improv and just play in general, right? Because I personally believe that improv is the purest form of play that we have available to us, because it is what we're born to do. Like, we're born and children just can play. They don't need any toys. Mm-hmm. They just know to play pretend, right? So an improv is like the adult version of that. I love that aspect of just looking at how, you know, we're able to just come into this like emotional being in improv and have it be a channel for releasing things and creating things as well, right? Creating emotions, releasing emotions.
Have you ever heard of Dr. Stuart Brown's 7 aspects of play?
No, I haven't.
So there is basically 7 properties of play that Dr. Stuart Brown talks about. So there's an apparent purposelessness to it. So it's the absence of practical value in the activity. It may not necessarily earn money or bring about material advantage. So that's how you define purposelessness. It's voluntary. You're not obligated to participate in it. It doesn't, you're not being dutiful by participating. If there's any obligation at all, then the activity loses its play component. The third one is inherent attraction. So play is fun. It makes us feel good. From a behavioral science perspective, it's said to bring about psychological arousal. In other words, it gets us excited and it's a cure for boredom. Number 4 is a freedom from time. When we are playing, we lose track of time. And that's true in improv. I have no idea what time it is when I'm playing there. It's freedom in its truest sense and provides escape from the constrained world of demands and commitments. 5 is diminished self-consciousness. When we're playing, we drop the need to look good. There's no concern for what others think of us. Now, you could be an improv and be very self-conscious. So this takes some work here to lose that.
I can totally attest to that, because I do have a lot of people who give me the note when I'm improvising, and I shared this on another episode, where people always tell me like, you're so in your body, you're so like, your physicality is great, you know? And from what I've gathered is other people are just self-conscious on stage, and that's why they're less willing to be more in their bodies, right? So yeah, totally can attest to that.
Yeah. So when you kind of lose that concern about yourself and you become lost in the activity itself, you're really in that play space. Improvisational potential. There's no specific system of doing things. Now, there are a couple rules to improv, like you say yes, that you support other people. But for the most part, improv is literally just open to serendipity and chance occurrences that lead to creativity and discovery of new things. And then 7 is the continuation of desire. So in play, we desire for its continuation and we'll invent new means to make it last. When you have a scene, you're doing this scene and it maybe you have to be in the scene for 45 minutes if you're doing a show. So I recently attended a show, and Andy Slowey, the general manager, and Kevin McKernan, the owner of the Improv Shop, they did this scene for 45 minutes, and they were these two characters, and they just had to keep inventing ways to stay in the scene. And
was it a monoscene? A monoscene?
No, it was their show. They call it Mrs. Somebody. Okay. And it's just two people. It's kind of like a long form for two people.
Got it. Okay.
So, you know, they're inventing new ways to make it last. It's the pleasure of the experience that drives the desire. And so from this, we make new rules so the game doesn't need to end. And if you think about when you're a kid and you're playing imaginary, you know, house or school or run from the Tyrannosaurus Rex or whatever you're playing, there's this continuation where you're continually inventing ways to keep playing. So these are the properties of play that make play the essence of freedom. Brown says that these things tie us down like a job that we hate doing, for example, the need to meet demands, follow rules, please other people. Those are things that end up making us miserable. In play, those things are eliminated. Play is its own reward. The activity is inherently enjoyable.
Wow, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. That's so valuable. It's incredible. Wow. I want to shift away, if you feel, you know, complete with everything we talked about, and get a little bit more into talking about the Enneagram. Yeah. And I want to just quickly share like my basic understanding of the Enneagram, which mm-hmm. is why I think it's so incredible. So I was listening to another podcast. I think it's called Normalizing Non-Monogamy. And they had someone on there, they were doing like a series about the Enneagram. They had an Enneagram expert, and something she said, which I never knew about the Enneagram, which I was like, oh my God, this is so fascinating and so cool, was that the Enneagram dates back to when history was passed down orally. Like there's no period where we have like a record of, oh, this is when it was invented, right? It's something that goes way, way, way back in human history. And I think that's so fascinating, because something that, you know, the person on that podcast said is that when something is that ancient and, you know, retains its integrity, right, retains like its meaningfulness, then there has to be truth to it, right? Which yeah. I just found so incredible and fascinating. So that's like my very, very basic understanding of it. Yeah. I don't know anything about it aside from that. But yeah, can you share more about that?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. So the Enneagram, it's an ancient spiritual wisdom tool. It started as an oral tradition that was passed down through many generations. It basically has 9 different types. And these are 9 different strategies of coping with the world, which are based on 9 basic human fears and desires. So these are archetypes of people. And these fears and desires, they inform our behaviors, which help us survive, but they can also get us stuck in unhealthy cyclical patterns. The Enneagram, these 9 personality types are actually our false personality. It represents 9 different egos of moving through the world. So our ego is a way of protecting ourselves. It's like a coat of armor that we wear to protect ourselves and get our needs met. Ego is not our whole self. It's just a part of ourselves. The Enneagram describes 9 stereotypical false selves. The more we learn how to identify what our false self is, then we can practice the vulnerability of taking off that coat of arms, lay our defenses down, and allow our true selves to come through. When our false selves are more predictable and habitual, that get us stuck in patterns that we don't want to be stuck in, our true selves are original and unique and authentic. So the Enneagram is helpful because it gives us a vocabulary to motivation underneath the behavior. Instead of putting us into a box, it actually reveals a box that we have already been living in, and then shows us that there are other ways of being and doing. So once you've observed yourself for a while, you kind of keep track of your thoughts, your preferences, your desires, and then challenge yourself to consider why you choose one strategy over another. And is there room to explore another approach?
Wow. I love that. I love that. And just from what I'm hearing, it sounds like, and I'm trying to like squeeze the play in there, right? Just from what I'm hearing based on the Enneagram and like the valuable information that we can get from that about ourselves, improv and playfulness, the energy of play, gives an opportunity to break those patterns, right? And to introduce new ways of being and living that otherwise wouldn't be available because we have been in that box, right? So it's like the recognition of the box allows you to then see other ways and just like explore that. Yeah. I'm just kind of like mind melting here, but wow, that's so amazing.
Yeah. Anytime you have the opportunity to be vulnerable. Now, vulnerability looks different depending on your personality type, right? So some people slowing down to rest is not that vulnerable because they are super chill and they rest all the time. There are other people where doing something new is vulnerable, but other people do that all the time. For some people, sharing personal stories, like they would never get on a podcast to talk about themselves. For me, that's not super vulnerable for me. So what I ended up doing a workshop series on the Enneagram and Brené Brown, and we looked at the different vulnerabilities of each type. And so I think improv allows you to take a step towards vulnerability, regardless of what your personality type is, because you have to trust other people. And vulnerability is when you cannot control the outcome. And so she has all these things on what vulnerability is and isn't. But one of the big themes is that you cannot control the outcome. And so ego, if you imagine yourself in a car and ego's in the driver's seat, ego is there to protect you. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It just is. And it's there to protect you and get your needs met. But if you're driving down the highway and you see an exit sign that says intimate relationship, or you see an exit sign that says improv experience, ego is going to say, oh, that's vulnerable. And I'm going to protect you from any kind of hurt or harm. So we're going to pass that. We're going to go 80 down the highway and we're going to fly down. Now, if you can reverse it and put ego in the passenger seat and you're in the driver's seat, which is what happens when you practice self-awareness and when you are able to use a tool, certain, like you can use the Enneagram, there are other tools available for sure that you don't have to use the Enneagram. But when you're in the driver's seat of your own car, you get to decide when you're going to take the exit and you're going to, she says, vulnerability is the birthplace of love, joy, connection, and belonging and creativity. And so you can't necessarily experience those things. You can't experience intimacy without vulnerability. You can't experience play, I think, without vulnerability or trust. And so you can say, thank you very much, ego, for warning me that this is a vulnerable exit, but I'm gonna take a chance and I'm gonna get off the highway. And that's breaking a cycle of a pattern that you normally would be in.
That is incredible. And I want to, these conversations have just been so fun for me on the podcast because I can see the different like connections. And so I had someone else on the podcast, BJ Lang, actually. And, you know, something that he shared was improv is it helps you to build your uncertainty tolerance, which I thought was such an incredible term. And he actually coined it to someone else. He's a researcher, a scientist who loves improv and does a lot of research around like what that does to the brain and all that different stuff. But that is such a parallel to what you're saying about that vulnerability aspect, right? And how vulnerability is not knowing, not being able to control the outcome, right? Like that's what uncertainty is, right? Is not knowing what's going to happen next and being okay with it, mm-hmm. right? And that's just so incredible because then when we look at, you know, spiritual concepts, that's a lot of what's taught as well, right? Is learning to, and that's what I teach to my clients as well, is being okay with the fact that, you know, things are not okay. Something, a phrase that I use all the time is you got to get comfortable with the discomfort.
Yeah.
Right. Like just like face the discomfort and be like, I'm comfortable here. Right. I'm okay. And that's a practice, right? Like that's something that it's like sweeping the floor, right? That's one of my favorite quotes from Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. Something he says is that, which is actually a quote from someone else, like a boxer, some athlete. And what he says is that training is like sweeping the floor, right? Just because like you train once doesn't mean that you're not going to do it tomorrow, right? Just because I sweep the floor today doesn't mean it doesn't need to be swept tomorrow. And that's the same thing with like building your uncertainty tolerance and, you know, building your comfort in the discomfort and being able to embrace vulnerability. That is all a practice, right? Yeah. It's not something that you just do once and then you're okay with it. It's something you have to do every day and, you know, be just, it gets easier with time because you're building the habit, right?
You build some stamina. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I love seeing all of these parallels because they're just so, you know, it like gets to the bottom of what the truth is. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So building the capacity to be uncomfortable, that is also what I teach. So I teach about So there are nine different types in the Enneagram. I teach about the nine different types of defense mechanisms that might happen when your ego is threatened. And that actually leads into some anti-racism training that I offer, just in terms of practicing identifying when someone says, you know, something that you're uncomfortable with, and you need to build your stamina for those uncomfortable racial conversations. And so when you are able to identify, hey, this is my defensive mechanism, this is my go-to one. We all have a lot of different ones, but we have kind of a favorite. And then defense, actually, when your ego is triggered, oftentimes there's a shame message that shame has like told you that you're not good enough. And so ego comes out to say, I am good enough, and I will prove to you in my defense mechanism that I am good enough. And so if you can, the Enneagram shares what each type's like trigger message is, but then also shares a path to healing of what is the healing message that you somehow missed out on hearing throughout your life. And what can you do to create a mantra or a practice to hear that message over and over again, so that your ego can stand down and that you can have those uncomfortable conversations without ego getting in the way.
Wow, that is so powerful. And wow, oh my gosh, I love that so much. That, yeah, that, oh, the Enneagram is freaking cool. I'm like, man, this is some cool freaking stuff. I gotta learn this, you know. That's so funny that you bring that up, because just a couple of days ago, I was hanging out with a friend of mine, and we were talking about, we like went on a hike, we're like smoking, we're just like fucking chilling, you know, we're like, let's have these deep conversations, you know, and we were talking about how our defense mechanisms are, like, we were talking about masculine versus feminine defense mechanisms, and meaning like passive versus aggressive, right? So like masculine defenses are going to be aggressive. They're going to be like action-based, versus feminine are going to be passive, right? It's like more. And so we were talking about how both of us have, because we were talking about just like past trauma we've had with like feminine, masculine energy and having an imbalance in those. And we were talking about how both of our immediate like favorite defenses are always feminine, which are like just passive, right? It's like not wanting to say anything, like wanting to just bottle up your feelings, wanting to just, right? And so then to combat that, we have to be like, actually, I'm gonna do the thing that I'm scared to do in this moment, which is like speak up for myself, or, you know, whatever it is. And so yeah, it's so fascinating you're bringing that up, because it's like a synchronicity and something that I'm, you know, kind of simmering in the back of my head. And the fact that that's in the Enneagram is like so cool and fascinating to me.
And I've been learning in my own therapy practice about the nervous system, the central nervous system, and our fight, flight, fawn, and freeze responses. So everyone knows it kind of about fight and flight. Fighting is standing your ground, being aggressive, probably some of those more masculine energy methods. Flight is going to be moving away from the threat. The fawn is actually people pleasing, so that the threat goes away. That's mine. And then freeze is numbing out, dissociating, kind of that just freeze until the threat goes away. And so our nervous system actually has a window of tolerance where we're in a good place to handle adversity. And when something stressful happens, we can become hyper aroused or hypo aroused. And so hyper arousal is that fight, flight, or fawn when we're going into overdrive to get rid of the threat. Another possibility, though, is to go into hypo arousal, which is freeze, and when you shut down. That's actually, if you look at like a lion chasing an antelope, and the antelope is, you know, it might try to flee, but after a while, if the lion actually catches the antelope, it freezes. It's literally stuck in this frozen thing. But what I've heard this story, I think this might be from the Burnout podcast episode, but if the lion decides it loses interest and leaves the antelope and it's unharmed, you see the antelope frozen for a little while, but then it starts to shake violently, and it shakes all of the trauma out of its body, and then it's okay, and it runs and joins the rest of the pack. And so that's when they talk about completing the stress cycle, and our nervous system helps us get, you know, deal with threats. And so if you're either hyper aroused or hypo aroused, and then completing that stress cycle to get you back into your window of tolerance. So anyway, there are certain types, I would say, in the Enneagram. Every type is capable of fight, flight, fawn, and freeze. But I would say that there are certain types that lean more towards the fight response, or lean more towards a freeze response or a fawn response, just based off of their personality. And so that's also an interest, that those are defensive mechanisms, actually. They're there for our survival. They're not bad. But when we get, our bodies can actually get stuck in those defensive mechanisms. And if we live in hyper arousal for so long, well, actually our body will compensate and go to hypo arousal. And vice versa. So this is called polyvagal theory, if anyone has ever heard of polyvagal theory. And it is a newer in somatic therapy. So I've been learning about that. And I've been actually tracking, I have a mood tracker on my phone. I've been tracking days that I feel like I've been in hyper arousal or hypo arousal, or if I've been in a good window of tolerance, because I want to make sure there are methods that you can do to bring yourself back to that window of tolerance, to stimulate your vagus nerve, which is actually we call it polyvagal theory, because your vagus nerve is one of the longest nerves in your body. It goes from your occipital lobe all the way down to your gut. And it ends up affecting so many different parts of you. So I've been very interested in how the Enneagram can overlap with polyvagal theory. So that's something that I've been playing around with.
Yeah, that's incredible. Those are like a couple of really cool modalities to merge. So Elizabeth, I want to give you an opportunity. I feel fairly complete with, you know, everything we chatted about. If there's anything else that you wanted to share about that we didn't touch on, is there anything that you wanted to share?
I think we covered a lot.
We did. Yeah, it was so good. So I just have a couple more questions for you. Mm-hmm. So first one is, if you just had one message to share with our listeners today, what would it be?
I would say take time to do the inner work, inner reflection. It's scary sometimes, but what that does is it requires you to slow down. You can't do inner work on the run. So if you live a fast-paced life and you like that fast-paced life, it's not bad to have a fast-paced life, but I would encourage you to think about cultivating a rhythm of rest, even if it's just 1 hour a week that you plan to just slow down for that hour, because you will be able to look within. And sometimes it's scary at first to look within, but actually what you're doing is allowing yourself to become your more truly authentic self that will be less predictable, less habitual, and you will have more control and more autonomy. You're not allowing your ego to drive your car, and you're just a passenger along for the ride. So if you want more control over your life, I would say looking within is actually going to help that. Rest and play are a big part of that practice.
Wow. Thank you so much. And so last question, can you share with the listeners where they can find you? If there's anything, any offerings you have right now that you want to plug and, you know, have people check out if they're interested in working with you?
Yeah. So my website is www.notjusteneacoach.com. That's not just E-N-N-E-A. Coach, coach.com. I'm not just any a coach because I also do acting and improv coaching, but I do Enneagram coaching as well. So if you are interested in Enneagram coaching and learning more about the Enneagram, I don't have any classes right now, any group classes that are happening right now, but if you're interested in an individual session, I can offer listeners of this podcast 20% off of first individual session.
So that's just amazing.
Mention Heal with Play podcast. If you go on my website, you can email me through my website and mention the Heal with Play podcast, and I'm happy to give you 20% off.
Perfect. That's so sweet of you. Thank you. Yeah, everybody go take advantage of that. You know, and Elizabeth, I just want to say also, your voice is so incredible. Like this whole episode, I'm listening, I'm like, this is the most, like, I'm just going to listen back to this. Like, her voice is so soothing.
Oh, thank you. You know?
I'm such a sensory person. I'm like, this is so nice, you know? But yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, everybody go check out Elizabeth, and I'll have everything linked down below as well. Any resources that we talked about today, and also all of Elizabeth's links, you know, where you guys can find her. And yeah, otherwise, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah,
it was such
thank
a
you
pleasure.
so much for thanks for having me, and thank you everyone for listening.
Of course. All right, bye guys. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Heal Through Play podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave a review and feel free to share your thoughts with me through an Instagram DM. I'd love to hear about how this episode resonated with you. Also, please check the show notes for links on how you can connect with me and the guest of today's podcast. There's also a link for a form you can fill out if you'd like to be featured on the podcast and share your stories of healing through the energy of playfulness. I also have incredible offerings for psychic readings, energy healing sessions, and light code activations. So if you're feeling called to do healing work with me one-on-one, then please send me a DM or a voice note on Instagram at Lisa Dovgish so we can dive into it together and see what kind of magic we can create in your life. And I also post some pretty dank memes. So whether you're interested in healing or just laughing your ass off, join the Instagram community. Again, thank you for tuning into this episode, and I can't wait to connect with you. Until next time.